Hello, Amish Furniture fans, and welcome to episode 7 of the Amish Furniture Podcast. I'm Beth Rice, co-host of the series from the largest online retailer of Amish furniture, Dutch Crafters Amish Furniture, where I have worked for 5 years.
And I'm Milka Rivera, your other co-host, and I've worked for Dutch Crafters for 4 years.
For those of you tuning in for the first time on the Amish Furniture Podcast, we give you insights into, if you haven't already guessed it, Amish furniture.
From misconceptions about Amish furniture and what it's like to start a business selling furniture made by the Amish, to Amish women's roles in wood shops and how Amish furniture is made, we explore that and more on the show.
The topic we are exploring on today's episode is Amish entrepreneurship. And to help us do that, we are ecstatic to be joined via Zoom in our respective makeshift studios by a special guest, Dr. Stephen M. Nolt. Dr. Nolt is a native of Pennsylvania who holds degrees from Goshen College, Associated Mennonite Biblical Seminary, and the University of Notre Dame. He currently serves as senior scholar and professor of history and Anabaptist studies at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College. He's a frequent source for journalists and researchers seeking information on Anabaptist groups, and he is the author or co-author of 15 books that primarily focus on Amish and Mennonite history and culture.
Some of the books that he authored include A History of the Amish, which is in its third edition, as well as The Amish, A Concise Introduction. He notably co-authored Amish Grace, How Forgiveness Transcended Tragedy, about the Amish schoolhouse shooting in the village of Nickel Mines in Lancaster County. And a few other co-authorships include the books Amish Micro Enterprises, Models for Rural Development, and Amish Enterprise, From Plows to Profits, and a paper titled Amish Enterprise, The Collective Power of Ethnic Entrepreneurship, which we'll mention a few times on the program today, that appeared in the Global Business and Economics Review.
Those last three titles tie in nicely to what we will be talking about today, so let's get into the episode. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Nolt. Milka and I are pleased to have you on today. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've graciously agreed to join us to talk about the Amish history of entrepreneurship and business, one prominent small business being furniture making and in turn the production of furniture. Would you first please tell us and our listeners how you became interested in Amish and Mennonite culture?
I grew up in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. I had Amish neighbors, and I'm from a Mennonite family myself. So I suppose in that sense, I came to it naturally, I guess you could say. Although my academic interests ended up going more in the direction of broader themes in American religious history and American immigration and ethnic history. But at a certain point, some of those topics and themes kind of circled back around to some of the communities that I was most familiar with growing up. I lived for about 20 years in northern Indiana, and got to know the Amish throughout Indiana and other parts of the Midwest. I'm now living back in Pennsylvania and reconnecting with some of the Amish folks here.
So let's get into today's topic. We're going to be touching on the history of Amish entrepreneurship and then entrepreneurship itself, and then hopefully getting into woodworking a little bit too, since that's our main area of interest. So the Amish were historically agrarian. They were farming land since before their migration to America. What are some of the factors that led them to moving from farming to other businesses, or have they always been entrepreneurial and interested in other things?
You're right. The Amish economic history is really a history of agriculture, and with a few exceptions here and there, Amish folks were historically farmers, both in Europe and in North America. That said, I think farming itself, small family farms, are, you know, by their nature, often very entrepreneurial. Today, we may think of agriculture in terms of agribusiness, of you know, a farm of 5,000 acres doing, you know, one crop or something like that. But historically, small family farms were involved in a lot of different things, and they changed what they grew in terms of crops and animal husbandry from year to year, certainly from decade to decade, depending on market demand, depending on family labor that was available. In the winter months, farm families would pick up extra work, be that in the colonial era, weaving cloth, or maybe more recently, building trades, or again, to connect with furniture, some sort of woodworking, that sort of thing. So farming often went hand in hand with other kinds of economic pursuits. So yeah, the Amish people have this heritage of farming, but it's also very much an entrepreneurial heritage.
And did they always sell to outside communities, or just, you know, when they were farming and they were making all these other items too, was it mainly within their own communities?
Amish economics has often been closely integrated with surrounding economies. One of the reasons for this, and one of the things that we maybe forget today, is that the Amish population historically was quite small. If we go back to 1900, there were only about 5,000 Amish folks, adults and children, in the US and Canada. Today, there are about 350,000 Amish people in North America. And so in some ways, the Amish economy, the more internal Amish economy, is in some ways stronger today, actually, than it would have been in, say, 1900. There just wasn't a large Amish market. And it's actually that population growth that is related to some of the shift away from farming. So over the course of the 20th century, given large families, typically Amish families today have six or seven children. So Amish families are larger than typical family in the U.S. And about 80 to 90% of children born to Amish parents join the Amish church. So when you have large families and a high, what we would call retention rate, you have an exponential growth curve in terms of population. And that's how you get from 5,000 Amish people in 1900 to more than 350,000 today. So at a certain point, the ability to acquire land for farming is outstripped by that population growth. In most Amish communities, the kind of pivotal decade for that was the 1980s. So particularly in the 1980s, you see not Amish people leaving farming, but during the 1980s, you see the rising generation, young people who are getting married, starting their own homes, not going into farming in the first place, but rather starting small businesses. And again, there's population growth that's outstripping the availability of land. You have also in the 1980s, in some of the same rural communities in which the Amish had historically lived, the emergence of suburbanization that was also taking farmland out of the market as there were housing developments and commercial other commercial development happening. So a number of those things are happening at the same time. There's some movement in the 80s for Amish people to leave geographically and start new settlements elsewhere. And we still see that happening across the country today. But the establishment of new settlements in more rural areas has never been enough numerically to take the demographic pressure off the older settlements. So the shift away from farming to small business has been pretty common in the last 30 to 40 years. Today in the Lancaster, Pennsylvania Amish settlement, about one third of household heads under age 65 are farming. In northern Indiana, it's actually less than 20%. But today, it's probably fair to say on a national average that less than half of Amish families are farming. Certainly, there are communities you can go to where almost everyone still is farming. But on the whole, there's definitely been a marked shift away from farming.
Interesting. Thank you.
Now that the Amish have largely moved away from farming, what are the most common types of businesses run by Amish entrepreneurs?
The shift away from farming drew on a lot of the entrepreneurial heritage that they brought with them from farming. So some of the first things that they became involved in were things having to do with what we might call machine shops and actually buying older farm equipment that they could retrofit or rework to fit with horse farming. Woodworking then was another early area. And again, drawing on a tradition of off-season construction trades, perhaps furniture making. So woodworking, including furniture building, both outdoor furniture, indoor furniture, cabinets, and would have been another area. And then we also saw by the 1990s, about 20% of Amish small businesses in the Lancaster community, at least, were being run primarily by Amish women. And those businesses tended to focus on things, again, traditionally tied to women's work, whether they be fabric stores, people who are just retailing retailing fabric, but then also people who are making and selling fabric crafts, be they quilts or other sorts of things, small retail stores, small grocery stores, bulk food stores, those sorts of things as well. So those were some of the main areas that emerged in the 80s and that we would still see today.
Could you maybe give us like a percentage of how many businesses are, you know, woodworking businesses? Since again, that's, you know, kind of our area of expertise. Do you have, you know, kind of a number? And is that still a really popular business to start nowadays? Or has that shifted a little bit as well?
So the percentage of Amish households working in woodworking would vary from one community to another. Here in the Lancaster settlement, my best guess is that about 10% of Amish businesses are in woodworking, if by that we mean, you know, things like furniture. So that may not, 10% might not sound like a lot, but the number of businesses, the kinds of things people are now involved in, are really very broad. So 10% is actually a sizable clustering here in this area. In Northern Indiana, the dynamic is a little bit different there. Unusually for the Amish population as a whole, there is in Northern Indiana a sizable number of Amish men and a few women who work in non-Amish industry, actually, working in factories that are manufacturing recreational vehicles and other sort of component parts. So again, you'd find the percentage of Amish folks working directly in woodworking to maybe appear relatively small, like 10%. But as far as a clustering of Amish-owned businesses, it's pretty significant.
No, that's great. And I think that's something that we've heard a lot of too, you know, where a lot of our Amish woodworkers actually started working in the RV industry. And then when, you know, the economy collapsed a few years back, they got into woodworking. It just seemed kind of like a natural, or making furniture, it just seemed like a natural thing to do. Or, you know, their father had been a woodworker and taught them how to make the furniture. So it seemed like a natural transition. So yeah.
Yeah. In Northern Indiana, there has been a bit of a shift away from factory work and towards small business since 2008. Actually, not quite as much of a shift as I might have predicted back in 2008. But first with a spike in gasoline prices in 2008, and then with a major credit crunch in 2009 and the onset of the recession, the RV industry really contracted for a time. And so there certainly were Amish men in that Northern Indiana area who had been working in non-Amish industry who decided to start their own businesses at that time. And many of them went into furniture making.
We've heard a few stories from some of the woodworkers who've visited our showroom in Sarasota also and spoken to us about their furniture. They tell a little bit of their backstory if we ask, and some have mentioned that they just were not cut out for farming, and this is how they got into turning to woodworking. We sometimes mourn the trends in the furniture industry that move toward cheaper products, poor materials, and bad construction techniques. In contrast, Amish woodworkers seem to be devoted to creating outstanding products that will last for generations. To what do you attribute this commitment to quality?
Well, I think there is a long tradition and heritage and cultural value on quality and integrity, hard work, just a sort of general work ethic that you bring from the farm that I think would all be part of that. Amish limits on technology, although they're not always as limited as some of us may assume, but certainly there are clear limits on technology that Amish folks use. I think also increases a commitment to handwork and to looking at, you know, just spending time with materials, spending time looking at wood. How does it look? You're working more closely with the materials. And I think that can contribute to a concern for what the finished product looks like, what it feels like, how it's put together. So I think that lack of mechanization also is a part of this.
You and your co-authors noted in your 2010 paper, Amish Enterprise, which we will include a link to in the show notes, that the failure rate of Amish businesses in the first 5 years is just 10% compared to 50% among small business startups nationally. To what do you credit that success rate?
I mean, one thing that I might comment on that I think is germane to Amish businesses generally, including furniture makers, is that there's this dynamic in Amish business between what we would call ethnic resources and ethnic restraints. So in the kind of larger world of ethnic group economics, we often talk about the role of ethnic resources. So in the Amish case, that could be things like heritage of entrepreneurship from the farm, work ethic, the use of family labor, like multi-generation families working together, simple lifestyle that reduces overhead. There's a strong commitment to mutual aid. We think of this in terms of classically in the rural context with the barn raising, but it plays itself out in the Amish business world with church-based mutual aid that is more cost-effective, frankly, than commercial health insurance. And yet provides a lot of the same coverage. So these are ethnic resources that contribute to the success of Amish businesses. On the other side, there are also what we would call ethnic restraints or constraints, limits on technology, limits on formal education, a humility theology that often keeps businesses small, maybe smaller than the market might suggest they could be. You know, other small things we might mention, like, no Sunday sales, prohibition on being open on Sunday, things like that. So we could list these ethnic restraints. And I use the word ethnic. I mean, these are, from the Amish perspective, religious restraints. But so we have these ethnic resources and ethnic restraints. And one of the things that's interesting in the Amish case is that these restraints are what, from an MBA perspective, would be considered restraints and maybe unnecessary restraints on business growth, have for the Amish actually become resources. That is, all these restraints have contributed to greater attention to quality, to funneling production into certain niche fields, and overall to creating an Amish brand. So these the interplay between resources and restraints in the Amish case, I think, from a business standpoint, is interesting because the things that might classically be considered restraints have actually become resources that have helped to bolster the Amish brand.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I know. I feel like that's not surprising to hear when you hear about how much the Amish community, you know, you mentioned the barn raising, how much the Amish community comes together. But it's still, yeah, like Beth said, really interesting to hear that they, you know, will help out other like businesses in that way too. And that kind of leads me into my final question about this. How has the shift towards furniture making and other just business ventures in general benefited the Amish communities?
Well, one of the ways that this has benefited the community as a whole is that it is in some ways economically easier to be Amish today than it was, say, 75 years ago. So this I think came up earlier in one of our earlier comments here, in which you mentioned that some furniture crafters have just said, well, they're not sure they were cut out for farming. And this seemed to fit a little better. So the range of occupations in which Amish folks find themselves is still narrower than the population at large. They're not high school or college graduates. So there are certain professional fields that they're not going into, but they're going into a wider range of occupations, certainly than their great grandparents did. You don't have to be a farmer to be an Amish person today. So I think that wider range of economic and occupational possibilities for men, and now for some women as well, is one of the contributing factors to the remarkably high retention rates in the Amish community. Again, 85 to 90% of children born to Amish parents joining the Amish church. That can seem a puzzle from the outside. And in fact, that rate of retention is a bit higher than it was 75 years ago. And I think one of the reasons is that there are more occupational opportunities available for Amish people today. Certainly, the shift to small business away from farming has provided more cash income in the Amish world. So, rather than say more of a commodity-based wealth that you'd find in farming that might only be liquid certain times of the year. The Amish business world is more of a cash economy. And so one sees that in the way in which mutual aid is now practiced. So cash-based funds that can be used or accessed for paying for medical bills, also for things like building Amish schools, building Amish schoolhouses. So in the past, this was, if there were, as the community grew geographically, more children were born, you needed more schools, it often fell on the parents of those children to pay for construction of a new school. And that still is the case some places. But nowadays, it's more common for wealthier Amish business people, particularly those of an age in which they actually don't have school-age children anymore, to anonymously provide the money for building a new school, which is a great help to the parents of school-age children who are often at a life stage when they don't have a lot of extra cash.
I love that. They just keep sharing within the community, which is lovely. Just keep raising up that community, which is, I think, something that we tend to lack nowadays where, you know, we have that very individualistic approach to everything. And so that's really nice to hear.
We're going to change gears and talk about some of the restrictions that Amish businesses may face based on their community rules, values, or expectations. In the paper Milka mentioned, you and your co-author said, "The Amish accept capitalist values, but these are mediated somewhat by the norms and regulations of the ethnic community. What norms and regulations impact Amish entrepreneurial pursuits and the ways they run their businesses?"
One of the questions that I personally had a number of years ago going into this research in Amish businesses was whether there were any formal limits on the size of a business. I remember very clearly talking to one grandfather here in Lancaster County, and I said something to him about, you know, is it, you know, what are the limits? Is it too big a building, too big a payroll, too big a sales volume? And he said, "I think the main limit would be if you get too big of a head," in which he was kind of coming back to the idea of humility and the important role of humility in Amish life, and that individuals who may be quite wealthy, but who maintain a humble outward demeanor, who are very generous with what they give and actually give anonymously, treat their workers right, and so on, may have a very large business that by any number of measures and be quite respected in church community. And someone might have a smaller business, not be expressing that sort of humility, and may feel community pressure to downsize or sell or something like that. So I think this role of humility, it's a little hard to put a number on. It's hard to quantify. And yet it's really pretty important. Now, having said that, there really aren't formal limits. I think from one community to another, based on the church order, or in Germany we say the Ordnung, or in Pennsylvania Dutch the Ordnung, restrictions say on technology do provide a kind of practical limit, a practical lid on the size of many communities. So businesses that rely on third parties to advertise or third parties to do computer work for, say, sales tax or other sorts of things, there's just kind of a practical limit there to what it is that they're going to do and how they're going to grow. Certain communities have limitations on the kinds of technology that they use that make it difficult to move into, you know, certain kinds of woodworking. So woodworking, for example, the most conservative Amish communities in terms of technology, their woodworking tends to be around sawmills or making shipping pallets, or, you know, things that are really pretty rough or further back the supply chain. Amish communities that have more leeway with the kinds of technology they use, and that maybe would have a large diesel plant from which they run hydraulic and pneumatic power into a shop, are going to be able to have more variable power equipment. Again, they're going to be doing more handwork than you'd find in a fully mechanized non-Amish shop, but they're going to be able to have have equipment with more variable power that's going to enable them to do more finer variability on everything from sanding to routing to planing and all sorts of things. So those kind of practical limits put a limit on the kinds of work that's done, how much one can charge, and who the ultimate market is. There's also a pattern, and this is something that's a little harder maybe to put one's finger on, but is something that pops up again and again, and you hear stories, and that is almost an expectation that sizable, thriving businesses will, from time to time, spin off a part of their business, maybe a particular product line, maybe a particular segment of their market, to one of their employees. It might be a child, might be an adult child, so it's staying within the family, but it's splitting, or it might be to another employee. And so kind of keeping businesses small by spreading out that entrepreneurial activity, rather than, one business continuing to get larger and larger, is also an expression, I think, of mutual aid and an expression of this value of humility. It's a kind of culturally strategic downsizing in which a growing business divides and is spread out among other family members or other employees.
We mentioned some of the titles of the books Dr. Nolte has written or co-authored. If you're interested in learning more about Amish and Mennonites and their communities, search for Dr. Stephen Nolte, N as in Nancy, O-L-T as in Tom, to find those.
Are there any resources from your own catalog or outside it that you would especially recommend to anyone like interested in learning more about the Amish and Mennonite history, culture, entrepreneurship, and all that?
I would also be happy to send you our Amish studies page here at the Young Center, particularly the section on statistics. We find that's the section that's most used, particularly by journalists, but is of interest to people. So we update that every summer. Well, a publication that listeners might be interested in is a publication called Plain Communities Business Exchange. It's published here in Pennsylvania. It's published by an Amish family. It comes out once a month. And there's a lot of ads, so it's a great way that Amish businesses can communicate with each other about who's selling what's available. You also have non-Amish businesses who want to connect with Amish firms. Maybe they're selling wholesale component parts or whatever. And you can get a good range of the kinds of businesses that people are involved in, some more agricultural, some more maybe to a tourist market, woodworking, metalworking, equipment, all sorts of things.
I'll definitely have to check that out. Yeah, it sounds really interesting.
Keep that in mind, listeners. That's the Plain Communities Business Exchange, and it's a monthly publication if you're interested in learning more. We would like to thank you again, Dr. Nolte, for joining us today for a very enlightening conversation on Amish entrepreneurship. Thank you so much.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you again to Dr. Nolte for joining us today. I'm looking forward to reading some of his books and learning more about Amish and Mennonite history and culture. Before I go on a book buying binge, though, do you like my alliteration there? Beth.
I love alliteration. I love those practices.
What is something new that you learned and or a favorite thing from today's episode?
Oh my goodness. What a great discussion with Dr. Nolte. A couple of things popped out. I liked when we were talking earlier and he mentioned the stat about 20% of the businesses being run by Amish women earlier.
Yeah.
And that was, I think he was referring to the period in the 80s too. So that was some time back. So I found that quite interesting. But one of my favorite things that I just thought was really provoking was when we asked him what he would attribute, the success of their businesses to, when you compare them with the failure rate, of other businesses. And he talked about their work ethic and their limiting technology. And I was thinking to myself, man, if I could just turn these electronics off, what else could I accomplish and how much more I could get done? And, you always have these excuses thinking, you know, oh, well, when the kids are grown, I'll have plenty of time to do X, Y, Z, and this is what's taking up my time. And just that, you know, that commitment to a simple lifestyle and shutting down the technology and setting aside. I need to get one of those baskets, you know, where you have a family function and they say, put your phone in here. And then no one's allowed to be on their phone while having the
They have safes, I think, where you can lock it. That you can put your phone in there and then lock it. Yeah. And then you can't use it for a certain time.
But it just struck me, you know, that when those things are removed, you know, look at what they've done and how successful they are, how unique and the great quality they produce, because they are focusing more on the what they're doing in their craft than any distractions. So, yeah, that just stuck out to me. What about you, Milka? What is something new from today's discussion or a favorite thing that popped out for you?
So I guess my big thing is that even though I realize that the Amish are evolving and changing along with society, you know, there are certain aspects that don't change, but it was really interesting to learn kind of how Amish businesses have changed over the years. You know, it went from farming into, and even then they were, it sounds like they were somewhat entrepreneurial then, you know, and, you know, he mentioned that the Amish communities were small. So they couldn't necessarily just sell within the Amish community itself. So that was really interesting to learn about, you know, even back in the day. You know, we live in Sarasota, so we see the Amish out and about, especially this time of year. We're seeing a lot that are coming down for the winter. And you see them still dressed, you know, the women are dressed in their long dresses and they have their head coverings on. And the men are still wearing, you know, dressier pants and suspenders and long sleeve shirts. So, you know, I think sometimes we see those things and we see them riding around on bikes. And so I think sometimes you see that and you think that they haven't necessarily progressed in some ways. And then you hear Dr. Nolt talking, and also just from working in the furniture business, you see how the furniture evolves over time too. And then you realize they're evolving too. You know, they're entrepreneurial. They want to keep their businesses thriving. And it sounds like a lot of times it's to help their own communities too, to keep their community strong and growing. So that's really interesting to hear.
It is. All right. That's it for today's show. If you enjoyed it, don't forget to like it or leave a comment or a review. Also, please be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
And be sure to join us next week for another exciting episode of the Amish Furniture Podcast.
Thanks so much for listening. Until next week.